Chapter 46. Incurably tainted by perjury proved against him in the courts. It makes U.S. smile down in my place. Because there isn't a rich man in your vast city who doesn't perjure himself every year before the tax board. They are all caked with perjury, many layers thick. Ironclad, so to speak. If there is one that isn't, I desire to acquire him for my museum, and will pay dinosaur rates. Will you say it isn't an infraction of the law, but only annual evasion of it? Comfort yourselves with that nice distinction, if you like, for the present. But by and by, when you arrive, I will show you something interesting. A whole hell full of evaders. Sometimes a frank lawbreaker turns up elsewhere, but I get those others every time. To return to my muttons. I wish you to remember that my rich perjurers are contributing to the American board with frequency. It is money filched from the sworn-off personal tax. Therefore it is the wages of sin. Therefore it is my money. Therefore it is I that contribute it. And, finally, it is therefore as I have said. Since the board daily accepts contributions from me, why should it decline them from Mr. Rockefeller, who is as good as I am? Let the courts say what they may? Satan. Introduction to the new guide of the conversation in Portuguese and English by Pedro Carolino. In this world of uncertainties, there is, at any rate, one thing which may be pretty confidently set down as a certainty. And that is, that this celebrated little phrase book will never die, while the English language lasts. Its delicious unconscious ridiculousness, and its enchanting naivete, as are supreme and unapproachable, in their way, as are Shakespeare's sublimities. Whatsoever is perfect in its kind, in literature, is imperishable. Nobody can imitate it successfully, nobody can hope to produce its fellow. It is perfect, it must and will stand alone. Its immortality is secure. It is one of the smallest books in the world, but few big books have received such wide attention, and been so much pondered by the grave and learned, and so much discussed and written about by the thoughtful, the thoughtless, the wise, and the foolish. Long notices of it have appeared, from time to time, in the great English reviews, and in erudite and authoritative philological periodicals, and it has been laughed at, danced upon, and tossed in a blanket by nearly every newspaper and magazine in the English-speaking world. Every scribbler, almost, has had his little fling at it, at one time or another. I had mine 15 years ago. The book gets out of print, every now and then, and one ceases to hear of it for a season. But presently the nations, and near and far colonies of our tongue and lineage call for it once more, and once more it issues from some London or continental or American press, and runs a new course around the globe, wafted on its way by the wind of a world's laughter. Many persons have believed that this book's miraculous stupidities were studied and disingenuous, but no one can read the volume carefully through and keep that opinion. It was written in serious good faith and deep earnestness, by an honest and upright idiot who believed he knew something of the English language, and could impart his knowledge to others. The amplest proof of this crops out somewhere or other upon each and every page. There are sentences in the book which could have been manufactured by a man in his right mind, and with an intelligent and deliberate purposes to seem innocently ignorant. But there are other sentences, and paragraphs, which no mere pretended ignorance could ever achieve, nor yet even the most genuine and comprehensive ignorance, when unbacked by inspiration. It is not a fraud who speaks in the following paragraph of the author's preface, but a good man, an honest man, a man whose conscience is at rest, a man who believes he has done a high and worthy work for his nation and his generation, and is well pleased with his performance. We expect then, who the little book for the care what we wrote him, and for her typographical correction, that may be worth the acceptation of the studious persons, and especially of the youth, at which we dedicate him particularly. One cannot open this book anywhere, and not find richness. To prove that this is true, I will open it at random and copy the page I happen to stumble upon. Here is the result. Dialogue 16, for to see the town, Anothony, go to accompany a gentlesman, do they see the town? We want to see all that is it remarkable here. Come with me, if you please. I shall not fulge at nothing, what can to merit your attention. Here we are near to cathedral, will you come in there? We will first to see him in outside, after we shall go in there for to look the interior. Admire this masterpiece Gothic architectures. The chasing of all the figures is astonishing indeed. The cupola and the nave are not less curious to see. What is this palace how I see yonder? It is the town hall. And this tower here at this side? It is the observatory. The bridge is very fine, it have 10 arches, and is constructed of free stone. The streets are very laid out by line and two paved. What is the circuit of this town? 2 leagues. There is it also hospitals here? It not fail them. What are then the edifices the worthest to have seen? It is the arsenal, the spectacles hall, the Cusium house, and the purse. We are going to see the others monuments such that the public pawnbroker's office, the plants gardens, the money offices, the library. That it shall be for another day, we are tired. Dialogue 17, to inform Onisulf of a person, how is that gentleman who you did speak by and by? Is a German. I did think him Englishman. He is of the Saxony side. He speak the French very well. Tough he is German, he speak so much well Italian, French, Spanish and English, that among the Italians, they believe him Italian, he speak the French as the French is himself. The Spanishesmen believe him Spanishing, and the Englishes, Englishmen. It is difficult to enjoy well, so much several languages. The last remark contains a general truth, but it ceases to be a truth when one contracts it and apples it to an individual, provided that that individual is the author of this book, Senor Pedro Carolino. I am sure I should not find it difficult to enjoy well, so much several languages or even 1,000 of them if he did the translating for me from the originals into his ostensible English. Advice to little girls. Good little girls ought not to make mouths at their teachers for every trifling offense. This retaliation should only be resorted to under peculiarly aggravated circumstances. If you have nothing but a rag doll stuffed with sawdust, while one of your more fortunate little playmates has a costly china one, you should treat her with a show of kindness nevertheless. And you ought not to attempt to make a forcible swap with her, unless your conscience would justify you in it, and you know you are able to do it. You ought never to take your little brother's chewing gum away from him by main force. It is better to rope him in with the promise of the first $2, and a half you find floating down the river on a grindstone. In the artless simplicity natural to this time of life, he will regard it as a perfectly fair transaction. In all ages of the world this eminently plausible fiction has lured the obtuse infant to financial ruin and disaster. If at any time you find it necessary to correct your brother, do not correct him with mud, never, on any account, throw mud at him, because it will spoil his clothes. It is better to scald him a little, for then you obtain desirable results. You secure his immediate attention to the lessons you are inculcating, and at the same time your hot water will have a tendency to move impurities from his person, and possibly the skin, in spots. If your mother tells you to do a thing, it is wrong to reply that you won't. It is better, and more becoming to intimate, that you will do as she bids you, and then afterward act quietly in the matter according to the dictates of your best judgment. You should ever bear in mind that it is to your kind parents that you are indebted for your food, and for the privilege of staying home from school when you let on that you are sick. Therefore you ought to respect their little prejudices, and humor their little whims, and put up with their little foibles until they get to crowding you too much. Good little girls always show marked deference for the aged. You ought never to ask old people unless they ask you first. Postmortem Poetry 1. In Philadelphia they have a custom which it would be pleasant to see adopted throughout the land. It is that of appending to published death notices a little verse or two of comforting poetry. Anyone who is in the habit of reading the daily Philadelphia Ledger must frequently be touched by these plaintive tributes to extinguished worth. In Philadelphia, the departure of a child is a circumstance which is not more surely followed by a burial than by the accustomed solacing PC in the public ledger. In that city death loses half its terror, because the knowledge of its presence comes thus disguised in the sweet drapery of verse. For instance, in a late ledger I find the following: I change the surname, colon, died, Hawks, on the 17th inst. Clara, the daughter of Ephraim and Laura Hawks, aged 21 months and 2 days. That merry shout no more I hear, no laughing child I see, no little arms are around my neck, no feet upon my knee, no kisses drop upon my cheek, these lips are sealed to me. Dear Lord, how could I give Clara up to any but to thee? A child thus mourned could not die wholly discontented. From the ledger of the same date I make the following extract, merely changing the surname, as before. Beckett. On Sunday morning, 19th inst. John P., infant son of George and Julia Beckett, aged 1 year, 6 months, and 15 days. That merry shout no more I hear, no laughing child I see, no little arms around my neck. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.